This is the audio from a recent Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube video. We've stripped the audio so that you can listen on the go.
It ended the Panorama documentary.
Yeah.
Which was a little bit preachier, I would say, than the first one.
Because actually, you and I agreed with each other on it. Well, look, I've had a drink with people from the Alcohol Health Alliance, and I've had a drink with you, so I'm in a very sort of centrist kind of way.
Hello there, folks. Welcome to another episode of The Swift Off with Snowden. I am that Christopher Snowden. We've got a fantastic guest for you today, a broadcasting legend in my eyes. They'll give you a few shows to get the appetite whetted. The one show, The Apprentice, You're Hired. Lots and lots of football, including Match of the Day. And a couple of documentaries about booze and this book. He is Adrian Charles. Adrian, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Not at all, Chris.
Now, I've got so much to talk about.
Go on, fine.
We've been here before, in this office.
Yeah.
For Panorama, wasn't it? You interviewed me for Panorama, but then it hit the cutting room floor. Nothing was used of what I said.
Oh, was it?
No.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
Well, I don't know if it fit the fit the narrative of the documentary. So you did a very cool documentary, what was it, 5 or 6 years ago?
Yeah.
Which was called, what was it called?
It was called Drinkers Like Me.
Drinkers Like Me, which was a, well, I mean, you can probably tell us, but it's sort of, it's a program about cutting down drinking, about
actually. Well, it was about, actually, the sort of the cutting down aspect came later with the book, but I think my thinking was that we had this idea of this thing called an alcoholic, which is a caricature or figure involved being blue lighted, waking up in a shop doorway or a skip or something. Mm-hmm. Life a complete disaster. And I knew I wasn't that. But then I could see that, well, hang on a minute, I don't countenance the idea of having any social occasion without drink. Mm. I can't remember the last day I didn't have something to drink. So how can I say I'm not, in some sense, dependent on it? And it was just kind of examining my relationship with alcohol. And I just blundered into it, really, because I realised a lot of people were in my kind of category. Just big drinkers.
You were knocking back about 100 units a week, weren't you?
Yeah, but I had no idea I was. Yeah. My dark secret, when building up to make the documentary, was, hang on, do I drink enough to warrant this? Am I a big enough drinker? And it was the first day we filmed at West Brom in the morning. We were playing Liverpool. Mm. At a lunchtime kickoff, and I met my mates in the pub we normally go into, and I had 4 pints of Guinness, which is a lot for me before a game, but by no means
for a midday kickoff.
For a midday kickoff as well, it's like 10:30 in the morning, right? It's okay, so that's on the high side. But then in the afternoon, I went for my mates for a cup of tea, didn't have anything to drink in the afternoon, got the train to London, or somewhere in the East End, it was my friend's 40th birthday, so went to this party, you know, obligatory glass of Prosecco or something. Might have had a pint or two for the thirst. Drank, I don't know, half a bottle of wine or a bit more. Maybe had another pint. And I wanted to go to bed, but then we went to some nightclub, had another pint of lager, finally got to bed. Now, at no stage that day did I feel drunk. It didn't feel like a big drinking day to me, really. And yet the following morning, and I did what all drinkers are supposed to do, which I've been haranguing drinkers to do ever since, is just count your units, see how much you've drunk. So literally only because I had a camera pointing at me and I was making this documentary, I couldn't get out of it. I counted up my units. I remember it was 36 units for that one day. Mm. And I just thought, blimey.
It's a lot.
I mean, that's a lot in anyone's book. And I soon realised, you know, people talk about 100 units, like it's a lot. But most days I'd meet, and my mate lived locally, I'd meet him for a couple of pints after work, 6, 7 o'clock. Then, so that's your baseline. And then you throw in a couple of proper nights out and maybe a long lunch on a Sunday and maybe a work lunch. I mean, you're getting into serious, you're getting into serious numbers kind of without knowing it.
But you weren't feeling ill as a result of this? You didn't feel independent particularly?
No, I didn't. Well, I only felt dependent when I considered, you know, the social side of it. What couldn't I face doing without drinking? And I had a conversation with a friend of mine's wife over Christmas. We had some school get together, and for some reason, I don't know why I asked her this question. She said, "What would you do if you told you couldn't drink?" You know, then she said, "I'd absolutely shit myself." And I thought, I've recalled about it. I thought, well, hang on, I actually feel the same way. So that must say something about my relationship to alcohol. And then, you know, in the making of this documentary, I went for this liver scan. And I didn't give it a second thought because I'd had a blood test, you know, the regular thing to the GPs, only about 3 weeks earlier, and that hadn't shown up anything. But then I went for this liver scan. It was some private hospital on Harley Street. Actually, when I went for the scan, I lay on my stomach. I didn't even know where the liver was. Because it turns out you're lying.
Not your kidneys.
You went, yeah, you're the other way, son. So, and then, you know, he did this scan, and then I went to his office later, and he said, well, you know, there's some evidence of fatty tissue there. You know, there's, you know, you could be on your way to cirrhosis here, and, you know, you've really got to cut down. You know, and I'm just about cynical enough to think, oh, great telly. But I'm 90%. I was absolutely horrified. You know, so what,
the program going to be about originally? Because you weren't concerned about your drinking. You didn't think you were drinking that much and you thought your liver was all right. So why did you pitch this idea to start with?
I thought most drinkers are in the category, or in a category which you don't see on television. All you ever see are the calamities, the blue lights and everything. And for a long time, the executive, the commissioner woman, Fatima, she said, well, you know, what are we going to film here? You're just used going around drinking moderately. Right. Yeah. I agree, really. Well, you know, let's see what gives. But then it just sort of got a life of its own, and it just resonated with a lot of people. And you know, I remember just after the program had gone out, I was at West Brom. We were at Birmingham City away on a Friday night, and at sort of half time, I ended up conducting what was like an impromptu kind of seminar, sort of drop-in session with people clambering over the seats to come in and discuss their drinking.
Because people always approach you now.
Yeah, yeah. But yes.
Am I drinking too much?
What am I doing? What are you? I mean, there's one guy, a proper big black country bloke. He was a, you know, you wouldn't have messed with him. And he goes, hey, I drink 50 pints of lager a week. He said, do you think that's too much? And, you know, ludicrously, I found myself adopting the tone of the urbane, forward-thinking doctor going, well, you might consider cutting out. No, but I sort of started saying that. And then in the end, what I said was, which is kind of the kind of spiel that led to me writing the book, was, hang on, look, if you're drinking 50 pints of lager a week and you're enjoying every single one of them, you're having good times and you get to the bottom of every single one and you've loved the bones of each one, then look, who am I to tell you not to drink it? But I mean, are you really enjoying every single one? And he went, oh, fair point. Then off he went, you know, for the second half. And I don't know what became of him. But it was this idea that, you know, of just
drinking for the sake of it.
Drinking for the sake of it. And I did, on the back of an envelope, I did a calculation during making that program, and I just thought, if I'd lined up all the drinks I'd drunk in my life in a long line, I worked out it'd be something like 3.5 miles long since I was 15, and I was in my sort of, you know, early 50s by this time. I thought, well, that's a lot to put through your system. But But for me, the tragedy was, if I think, how many of them did I really want, need, enjoy?
Yeah.
You know, one or more of those.
And you try and catalogue this in the book. Yeah. Each chapter.
Yeah. And then I just looked at it, but I think it's only about a third.
Really?
And I just, and I went back as honestly as I could. I went back and looked back at my, kid writing the book, it turned into a kind of a drinking memoir. And
yeah,
I was shocked and sort of a bit upset about just how much my life had revolved around it, you know, from a, you know, the classic, you know, 15-year-old. I know it was like where you were born in North Yorkshire, but, you know, you'd find, you know, round by me, you'd find, you know, you'd word and get round of a pub where you'd get served, you know, even though you hadn't started shaving and you're only 16 and a half.
Not to mind the countryside.
Yeah. But all that mattered was, can we get a drink? You know, can we drink? Everything seemed to be the solution to everything. I remember my dad saying, when I was about 15 or something, I must have been, and he says, difficult age for you now, and it's like you're too old to stay at home the whole time, but you're not old enough to go to the pub. And I, you know, bless him, that I knew what he meant, but, you know, it sets up the, you know, the 18-year law, you've got to be 18 to drink. You know, it sets the pub up, this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Right. Everything will be fine once you can go to the pub. Mm. You know, and I'm not sure whether I think you should abolish the, you know, that rule, but...
You can go in with your parents at 15 now.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
If you have a meal, I think. It was one of Blair's liberalisations.
Mm.
I don't think people use it very much. People don't really want to go to the pub. Parents have a meal, do they suppose?
No. You know, that's true. And I suppose a lot of people go through that phase, then grow out of it. But I just realised I was drinking more and more with every decade that went past. And I was
I've been really reading it today.
Yeah.
I love it. It's certainly not a misery memoir, is it? I mean, it does sound, I have to say, like you're having a whale of a time in each of these decades.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's also, look, just how many you only remember. You only remember the good times. Mm-hmm. You don't remember, and it's not so much the bad times. You remember if you fell over, banged your head and ended up in A&E. Obviously you remember that. But what you tend not to remember by nature, by the nature of boring times, you don't remember the boring times. But I go back and I just think how many times I went out. You know, it was time to go home at sort of 9 o'clock or something, but you don't leave a pub before closing time. In fact, one of my big drinking mates at the time, who grew out of drinking as much. In fact, I drink a lot quicker than with him. You know, he lived in Malaysia, but he's come back to living back near where we were brought up. And I met him in that old local pub, the Station in West Hagley, and we had a couple of pints then. I'll be off then. He had to get the train. And he was like 8:30. And I said, God, Rich, can you, you know, when did we ever leave a pub before closing time? Mm. And then I now can't remember, actually, the last time I was in a pub at closing time.
Right. You know, this is my last question. So you're sticking to this now, eh? Because at the end of the documentary, I think he said, I'm down to about 30, 35 units.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that's twice as much what the chief medical officer says. But
Yeah.
So there's been no backsliding since then. You're still around the 30 years.
Through phases. As I mentioned, my dad died recently and everything went, you know, and then sort of everything was just mega up stressful. And so at times like that, and then I'll probably drink more. I don't know how much it would probably get up towards 50 years. But generally, I'm about sort of 20, 25 units, I suppose. I mean, and that's one of my big issues, but that's one of my big issues with this, with the guidance. You know, I don't dispute the 14 units for men as marking some kind of, you know, point in at which the graph changes.
Yeah, because it's completely made up.
Okay, all right. Well, we disagree on that. But anyway, but my point is that they set this up as almost, well, if you can't get down to 14, then just don't bother. You know, it's 14 or nothing where, you know, marginal gains are available. You know, the way the harm curve works is that going from 60 units to 40 units is a massive benefit to you. More, I think, as my understanding of it, going from 30 to 10
yeah, right.
or something. You know, so I just think we, that, you know, that is a point that should be made, but you don't see that. You don't see that in the messaging.
And yeah, just apart from the fact that it's actually unscientific to 14 years, it seems to me counterproductive almost. I know you say in the book that 70% of people stay within the guidelines.
Yeah.
People like me and you are always surprised by that.
Yeah.
Now, there's probably a bit of undercounting there, but I'll go with it. I think that, yeah, a lot of people aren't that bothered about drinking. That's why so many people stay within the guidelines. 20% of the population don't drink at all. And a lot of them, particularly millennials, actually. These
but that, but that, I wasn't counting that within that 70%.
Oh, that's all drinkers. Fair dues. But of people who actually like a drink, going to be drinking more than 14 years. I don't think it's helpful apart from anything else, because people are just going to go, well, might as well get hung for a sheep as a lamb.
Yes,
I go way over it. If it was something like 35 or 40, something like that, people might actually, it might have some credibility and people might make an effort to stay
with sort of big drinkers like us. Well, you know, I'd still put myself in that category. I think the biggest thing I found, this was long after I made the documentary, is that I did realise that whether it's 70% of drinkers drinking within the 14 units or, but even allowing for a massive error, there are more than half.
Yeah.
And I just think that is really important to get your head around, because the social norming of drinking is really important. It's a really big factor.
Yeah.
So, look, by
the
way,
you're a drinker. The people you're meeting are people in pubs. Exactly. Right? So there's a selection bias.
Precisely. And look, I think my objection is, I don't mind somebody saying, look, 14 units, that's all bollocks, right? Whether it's you or, you know, somebody who hasn't done any homework and just saying it because it suits them. But what I can't have is somebody saying, well, everybody, come on, I drink 30, everybody drinks 30, 40. It's just, that just isn't true. That is measurably untrue. So, you know, I think that should be out there. But what you say about, what do you put it? Bias. What is it?
Selection bias. And who you meet.
I mean, that is such a big factor. You know, I went, so, you know, you fresh start going off to university. So I go to, you know, I went off to, came to university in London from the Midlands when I was 90. Let's say in the 4 years I was at university, I made probably 25 friends, stroke acquaintances, and probably 5 lifelong friends, right? By an extraordinary coincidence, they're all drinkers.
Yeah.
You know, my best mate, when I met the first week, is a Catholic guy from Catholic guy from Consett in County Durham. And I said to him, I think it was Thursday of Fretcher's week, he said, you coming up the bar? And he went, no, I'm going to Mass. And I went, are you what? And I said, I thought he was joking, but no, sure enough, he was going to Mass. Now, I always told that story in the context of religion. Because I took my first communion as a Catholic when I was 40. It was sort of in my kidney, but he was the first sort of Christian person I've ever met. It was like me, i.e. liked beer and football and swore a lot.
Right.
But setting that aside, what's more profound for me is that if he'd answered the question differently in that Thursday or fresh week, I said, you come into the bar? And he said, no, I don't drink. Mm-hmm. I would never have been friends with him. Right. I undoubtedly would not have ended up friends with him. You know, I think, you know, that's, you know, pretty shocking. So, you know, we surround ourselves with drinkers like us, which skews our texture.
Yes, and the range of how much people drink.
Yeah.
Because you can always find someone who drinks more than you.
Yeah, well, no, that's true. And you always focus, every big drinker will never tell you about people they've got who drink miles less than them. They will always have a story of somebody, you know, oh, you should see them. Oh, blimey. You know, what he can put away. You know, it's absolutely extraordinary.
So after the first documentary, you then did the Panorama documentary.
Yeah.
Which was a little bit preachier, I would say, than the first one. Which yeah. It's all preachy. That was a bit more policy-based and, you know, people like Ian Gilmore.
I mean, that was just on... Actually, it's coming back to me now. You said you end up on the cutting room floor. It's because actually you and I agreed with each other on it.
About the guidelines?
Well, not about the guidelines. It wasn't about the guidelines. It was about labelling.
Oh, right.
Right. And it was about, and as you know, as a good libertarian, you say you should have complete information. And there'd been so much foot dragging on labelling the, you know, on labelling the, you know, how many units were in, and it was incredibly small and all the rest of it, in, you know, how many units were in each, you know, each pint and so on. And I just thought, you know, well, that's, well, I think we agreed, you know, it's just not
critical. You wanted to have the calories on the pumps, is that right?
Well, that was another aspect of it, to have the calories.
And my point, I think, was that they all have more or less the same number of calories, so what's the point?
Well, yes.
If you've got 200, 205, 210, yes, who cares?
Also, I think people generally would be quite surprised how few calories there are in alcohol.
Oh, you think so?
It's significant. And I think it'd be a big drive. Well, look, I think you look at a pint of Guinness. I think it's about 100. I think Guinness is one of the lower ones, bizarrely.
Yeah.
I think.
But people have this idea that there's a lot of calories in Guinness.
Yeah.
Because of the old advertising.
But I think it would probably, particularly amongst women, I mean, the thought is if you how many calories you put there was, if that was put on there, it'd be a driver, it'd be to get consumption lower. But, I mean, just on that, for me, there was a huge anomaly, is that there's actually an exemption for alcoholic drinks. You know, you buy a pint. It doesn't have to tell you how much alcohol there is in that
pint. Ingredients
or a can, yeah,
even the ingredients,
yeah. But you buy a bag of crisps to go with it. Mm. It's got to tell you the whole lot. If you buy an alcohol-free beer, that's got to put the calories on it.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, but alcohol doesn't.
So what did we agree on this? That we should have labelling?
Well,
that,
I think
that
just
not a clear label, not a cancer warning on it, which is what the
maybe ever. I don't know. I don't think I've got a particularly strong view either way. I mean, the message I want on there is it's less about what you can't do or what you shouldn't do.
It was about than
what you can do.
Right.
So I would say, you know, look, you can, you know, if you could say, you can enjoy up to 14 units a week, or I'd put it at 30 units or whatever.
Yeah.
You can drink up to 13 units a week relatively safely. So keep it to that and really enjoy it. And you come to know what.
It would be a perfectly good label.
Or another one, you know, be like, and I noticed one of the betting companies, I think it might be Sky Bet, but I've seen this message going around, you know, on those advertising hoardings around grounds. And it says, you know, most gamblers or most people who bet with us bet responsibly, be like them. To that, there should be some kind of messaging along the lines of most drinkers drink moderately, you know, be like them. Or something like that. I'm not a copywriter.
So, you know, well, this is a nudge. This is behavioural economics.
Yeah, yeah.
They're telling people to try and anchor them.
To try and anchor them.
The information we were talking about before, that most people actually drink relatively little.
Exactly.
But you see, the anti-alcohol people, they don't like this gamble responsibly or drink responsibly. The anti-gambling people don't.
No.
Because they think it's too vague. No. They say no one knows what drink responsibly means.
But it's
I think people do, don't they? What do you think of when I say drink responsibly?
Well,
you might not be thinking specific number of units, but sure you're thinking, don't drink and drive. Don't get pissed if you're pregnant.
I think there's that.
Drink a load of shots when you're about, you know, on an empty stomach.
Yeah, I think there's that. I think moderately is the bigger problem because everyone's got a different idea of what moderate is, you know. So I think that's a bigger issue. But it's interesting to me why drinks companies don't bang on about the most drinkers are drinking moderately. Because, you know, I am pretty sure that's to do with social norming.
Do you mean on the labels or in public affairs?
In the public affairs or even advertising.
When it comes to, you know, whenever there's someone like Ian Gilmore saying we need minimum pricing, what have you, the typical sort of Portman Group response is most people drink within the guidelines, and that number has increased over the last 20 years, and this has all happened about regulation.
Yeah, and I think... Yeah, but I just... You see it on the... I'm talking more about advertising. Look, there's always going to be a battle between the alcohol company's got to shift product. I absolutely get that. And the health lobby has got to find ways of nudging people away from drinking too much. I mean, I suppose it's a fantasy for me. I don't know how you're supposed to advertise it if you don't show images of people leaping around, having a fantastic time. You know, you don't just...
Well, they tend to be people having a quiet sup, really, don't they? Most of the drink adverts.
Well, it's like party time, Bacardi, well, and all that. You see them.
Yeah, but, yeah, that, true, with the Bacardi, you see a bit more of that, yeah.
Sort of jumping around up, and, you know.
Whiskey and things, it tends to be a, you know, measure old man in an armchair.
Yeah,
that kind
yeah,
of thing,
exactly.
So what do they make at you at the Alcohol Health Alliance these days? Because your message is basically, this is in your hands. You can drink moderately, you can drink responsibly.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think that's a very effective line. And also, of course, you're saying that 30-ish units is perfectly all right.
But I'm
on the other hand, you're a celebrity who's talking about drinking and kind of on their side and to some extent.
Well, I think I'm... Well, look, I've had a drink with people from the Alcohol Health Alliance, and I've had a drink with you. So, I'm in a very sort of centrist kind of way. I'm sort of getting away with it. But I think they are... I understand what I was trying to do, because, you know, you can be doing yourself harm potentially without knowing it, without being at the extreme end, you know, the 5% drinker drinking extraordinary.
You're about alcoholics,
alcoholic is another troublesome term. I don't know. Then there's plenty of, in my understanding here, there's plenty of sort of academics are also not sure about alcoholism as a thing. You know, if you smoke 80 cigarettes a day, you're not a smokeaholic.
You're a smoker,
but I just think alcohol is, I don't think it's as addictive, it's not as addictive as nicotine, but it's...
It can be to some people.
To some people, yeah. But, you know, if you're drinking 20, 30 units a week, you're a bit dependent on it. You're drinking, like I was, between 50 and 100. You're considerably dependent on it. If you're drinking more than that, you know, you're hooked. You're very dependent. I don't think calling it an ism, like it's a disease which you have or haven't got, I just think it uses up an awful lot of wasted mental energy and time. The question people always say, well, am I an alcoholic or aren't I? It's not like that. If you're drinking all that, a better question is, how much am I drinking? Am I totally dependent on it? Mm. Because if it's an ism, then it's very, you know, it's much easier to convince yourself you haven't got this ism.
But it isn't that.
Not least because no one can actually properly define it, and we have the mental picture of what an alcoholic is.
Well, you are sort of defining it, because you're saying if you're dependent on it. And in the book, you make the distinction. You say, that I am proposing essentially moderation. Yep. However, if you're the kind of person who cannot stop drinking, and ends up like Frank Skinner or someone, right? Then you're probably an alcoholic, and you should probably knock it on there completely.
Yeah.
So there are. You are.
I did just say. I wouldn't use the word. I don't think I use the word alcoholic.
No, I don't think you do.
But... for some people, I'm just saying there's an assumption, and there's an assumption that if you're a big drinker, you won't seek help. You won't seek help. You won't go to the doctor about it and say, look, I need to cut down. Because you think, in some cases correctly, that you're going to be told the only way is to stop completely.
Right, yeah.
And I think that puts off an awful lot of
from
people
seeking help.
From seeking help. Also, something else I've never really explored because I found it too unsettling. A few people said to me after the program and the book, said, oh, I wouldn't go to the doctor because... I wouldn't go to the doctor because, you know, about drinking, because it'll end up on my records. I said, well, they're confidential, aren't they? So I asked a few GPs and they said, yeah, but. And the but is that, yes, you cannot disclose it, but if a health insurance or life insurance come to your GP asking for details, I've never really explored it because I don't want to know because it absolutely should be bloody, it should be absolutely confidential.
I would have thought.
I thought a lot of women particularly, they are worried they might get children taken from them and so on. Now, it might be a misconception. So, look, I haven't really done my homework on this.
But people think it.
But, you know, that people think it.
Yeah.
The problem with moderating is that there's no beginning or end to it.
Mm.
You know, it has said, I spoke to a woman, a famous actress, and she's for some podcast about drinking. And she said, oh, I'm going out tonight to celebrate my third year of abstinence. I said, oh, great. And then I thought, well, what, you know, there's no anniversary for a moderator. How much do you drink on your moderation celebration apart from anything else? Do you know what I mean? There's no end to it. And I still ask myself awkward questions and questions I haven't got answers to. There was one guy, a guy from Politics Joe, who did one of the better interviews I had when I was talking about the book. And he said, look, of all the great nights in your life, how many haven't? Your great nights in your life, how many haven't involved alcohol? And I thought,
not really.
That's a good question. And I've had, you know, well, look, it's the exception. It's the exception, not the rule.
Definitely.
It's all I'm saying. I mean, also, you know, I talk a lot about moderation. And I think, somebody said to me, a really clever therapist in the book, I thought, she said, yeah, but what if you know, we're working on this pain. He said, you know, the first pint is the one that really makes the difference. You get a change of state from that. Change of emotions end with that first pint. Second pint, less so. And
diminishing
returns. And I think about, you know, diminishing returns. Third, you know, and in that context, I started seeing every subsequent drink after the second as just a vain attempt to try and recreate the feeling that the first one got you and it's diminishing returns. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. But as the woman who sort of posited this theory with me said, we said, but what if you're drinking for oblivion?
Yeah.
I said, well, that's a different model of drinking. I'm not judging anybody, but look, if it's oblivion you're after, then that's, you know, my book's not really going to help you because, you know, moderation will bring you a lot of things.
Drinking completely, yeah.
Well,
but I think that's the distinction between, I'm going to use the word again,
that might be a distinction.
I'm like you, I don't drink to get drunk. In fact, I don't even like being drunk.
No.
And I make sure I pace myself so I don't get too drunk and lit.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Certainly it's not why I'm drinking.
No. Now, that's interesting. Also, what I heard over and over and over again was this, the notion of the off switch. I've got no on switch.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got friends. Look, my best mate, the one I used to go out and have a couple of pints with every night, for him, he got to the stage where he just can't do it. And I really feel a bit sorry for him. In fact, someone else who drank in our local was Paul Cook from the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And he said something interesting about it. He said, this guy we were talking about, he said, you know, I feel a bit sorry for him because he really can't just enjoy a pint or two pints because he just finds it almost that too painful to stop. Now, and a lot of people have got that, I think, when they start, they can't stop. Now, I think you and I are lucky, not what we got, so an appetite for alcohol. But I think, you know, we don't have this compunction just to go and go and go until the lights are out and there's nobody in. I mean, interestingly, with food, I definitely haven't got an off switch. Once I start eating, I can't fucking stop to save my life. I mean, literally, I've got to leave the room or something. You know, that's really a bigger challenge for me.
Interesting. Adrian, we're running out of time.
Okay.
That's how quickly it goes. Folks at home, this is a very good book. Okay. A Good Drinker by Adrian Charles.
I've got the paperback version, actually, which I'll, for you, which I'll give you. When it's got some reflections at the end from all the wisdom I got from various people I spoke to after the publication.
Yeah, this is almost a full-time job for you now, isn't it, counselling people about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, people want to stop me in the street. They ask me, well, I'm not on telly so much anymore. How much am I drinking now? And our West Brom are doing. Those are the three subjects.
Not too bad. Right, folks, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.